G'day folks, talk to Jeff Trappert, a recipient of the Order of Australia medal and a gold medal from the 2000 Paralympics. And he runs his own company, Inclusion Moves, which is set on policy change. For people with disabilities, if anything affects them, they should be a part of the conversation for the same social opportunities as everybody else out there. He's doing solid work. Keep it up, brother. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Jeff Trappert, much appreciated, mate, you coming on and having a yarn with us on Keep Rolling. And, mate, want to say, very impressed with the background there.
I try and be legit as I can when I'm doing professional stuff, mate. I mean, I'm the first to admit I do slip back into not being too professional at times. I tend to wear the suit and the tie, and then act like a bogan while I'm wearing it.
Yeah, well, you're looking sharp, mate. Looking fit. So,
thanks, mate.
Mate, so how's it generally been up in Queensland? Like what we were just talking about beforehand, just COVID, how's it affected your state, and how have you been feeling and with the family and everything?
Look, we've been pretty lucky in Queensland, realistically. We haven't had that much trouble. I've obviously had trouble work-wise, trying to do the kind of work that I do. And being locked out of Sydney and Melbourne, and because most of my work comes from down there, not too much inclusion and diversity consulting happens in Brisbane, funnily enough, tends to happen more down south. But so absolutely, we took a hammer in work-wise, which is starting to pick up. And family-wise, with a daughter with CP, it's been challenging working with having support workers come in and trying to keep everyone safe and trying to make sure that we're lucky enough that neither of us would have really been too affected by COVID, even if we did catch it. So accepting that privilege, it was then more about trying to make sure the rest of your community was safe, and you were doing your bit to keep them safe was the big bit for us.
100%. And with the general community, how has that been with like COVID and like what? Are people generally keeping safe, wearing masks? Like, I know it's been a bit different, say, when you look at the vast differences going from Victoria, where fully locked down, compared to Queensland. Like, you guys are probably the most lenient, well, probably I'd say in the most sort of safest space.
Us in Northern Territory, we're pretty safe from the whole thing on the whole. We actually found we live in a bit of a strange, that sounds bad when I say it, but we live in a bit of a strange spot in Queensland. We live just outside of Brisbane, so hour or so west of Brisbane. And that gives, but I do most of my work in Brisbane. So I kind of see both sides. I see the countryside where people are, nah, she'll be right. This is all just a hoax, mate. And see that at home in the home community and then go into Brisbane. All of a sudden, people are taking it a hell of a lot more seriously. So for me, I kind of got to see a couple of different versions of how the community took it.
So
which was funny.
Did you see a version? Because you're saying like, yeah, the laid back Australian reactions to most things. Yeah, she'll be right, mate. But was there any sort of conspiracy theorists coming through that saying?
Absolutely, mate. The further you go out in the country, the more you're susceptible to some of that. That anti-government stuff starts to kick in, and hey, that's as long as you've got an open mind about it, and you can be convinced the other way, then that's human nature. There's always gonna be people that will grab hold of those conspiracy theories, and it's about putting out good information as well to make sure you counteract in it. There'll always be that minority. As long as that minority stays to a minority, we're not doing too bad.
That's all right, you know. Hopefully it's just a small circle of people wearing tinfoil hats, eh?
That's it, mate. That's it. So I hid mine away for you. That's why I've got the virtual background, so you don't see the tinfoil hat.
You heard the man. Yeah, but yeah, crazy. So let's reel it back a bit. So we got, you know, the important work that you do with inclusion moves, very important. But where did it all kick off with yourself, mate? Like, as in, who is Jeff Trappett? Have you always been a Queenslander? Were you born up that way? Who are you? And then, you know, and then take us, and then we'll jump into a bit of, you know, your athletic career, mate.
Yeah. So always been a Queenslander. Born in Brisbane. Still live just outside of Brisbane. So on Jagera and Turrbal people nation. My experience in disability, I was born with a disability, so born with spina bifida. I tend to gloss over that bit these days. It's funny, when you're born with a congenital disability, you tend to gloss over that bit, and then you think, hang on a sec, people probably want to know that story. People probably want to know that bit because they're used to hearing the stories from those that have had accidents and such. And the guys with a congenital disability tend to skip it over. But born with a disability and was lucky enough to have really good parents. I was saying in a talk the other day that my first inclusion and diversity experience was probably with mum and dad, and it was the fact that I wasn't treated any different than my older brothers and sisters. I've got two older brothers and a sister.
And that's awesome.
When they were growing up, they were expected to, we're a pretty normal Australian family, they were expected to do some type of sport, and when I grew up, I was expected to be absolutely no different. So that kind of set me on the path that to not only the sporting stuff, but also good inclusion and diversity values, which the sports stuff kind of lasted for a few years, but the inclusion and diversity stuff is going to be lifelong. So that's one
spot
of those
on
that is really really close to my heart.
So inclusion and diversity, growing up, youngster in a wheelchair, rolling along through Brisbane and throughout Queensland. So what was it like generally, like with the community?
Yeah.
From the community viewpoint, like how did you feel like growing up, and what did you see as a youngster? Like before you sort of got into athletics and going through, like, say, general school systems, like just general acceptance from the community, and how did that all roll out?
For me, I didn't realize at the time, but I went to two different private schools when I was growing up. So again, show a lot of privilege there. I understand that. But what I didn't realize at the time is one was Catholic and one was Anglican, and we weren't religious whatsoever. And it obviously didn't click to me at the time, but the reason mum and dad chose both of those schools was because they were good with access and good with inclusion. That's one of those things, as a youngster, you don't realise what mum and dad are actually setting you up with. The choices they were making right from a very young age were actually about your disability. And that tells you, now that I work in that world, that tells you that the choices were actually limited by my disability, which is something we're still trying to bash down these days. But growing up as a youngster, I was lucky enough to be good at sport from a fairly young age, and again, with that comes a whole lot of privilege. Australia being a sport-made country, I don't know whether you do, mate, but I often get asked to talk about bullying and those kinds of issues, because a lot of people assume that because you grew up with a disability, you were bullied, and I was lucky enough not to, and that's absolutely not right, because it was absolutely because I was good at sport, and the community kind of cancelled out my disability by going, oh, but he's good at sport, so he fits in. He's one of those cripples that fits in, mate. And that I didn't realise that at the time, obviously as a youngster, but now doing the kind of work I do and seeing the kind of experiences of my peers, I absolutely know that that's not right, and that's not the way we should be growing up. We should be living our lives and building our community now. So that's a lot of the reason why I do the work I do.
Yeah, that's great. You know, like, and that's interesting for me. Like, just knowing general communities that And that's as a whole, you know, how people are generally, like if it's people that are good at sports and then people that aren't, just the vast differences at how people through society are sort of held at different levels and they're sitting on different podiums. But, you know, it is what it is, so disability or not. But it's great to hear that, you know, growing up that it was a positive environment, your parents were all over it, your community seemed like it was all over it, and you know, and you're fitting in well into the sports scene. So how does one, like growing up, like where were you gathering inspiration from, whether it was people within the disability sector or people that didn't have disabilities, like with sports, where were you grabbing inspiration from to get in the type of sports that you were participating in?
Well, I probably started doing wheelchair sports when I was about 10. So sort of about there that you start to get, you start to move from your, I had able-bodied role models when I was growing up, and I still do now. But I did start to, as I got into doing sport at about 10, start to see those role models in the disability sector, in the disability community as well. And I probably got a mixture, mate. This is going to get a little bit controversial, but I'm not actually one of those ones that sees that a person with a disability, that you have to have, I'm trying to choose my words so I don't get to, so I don't come across wrong, but I don't see that the representation of people with disabilities the be all and end all. We talk a lot about people with disability being represented in the media and being represented in advertising and those kinds of things. And absolutely, it's important. But to me, it's not actually the be all and end all. It's what you're looking at in those role models. It's important, not necessarily what they look like. They have an outwardly looking disability. It's that they've got good inclusive values. So some of the role models that I'd look up to would be those guys that were on the team supporting the white fella that was on the sporting team that supported the Indigenous guys to be out there and in the public and wanted them to have their voice too. They're the kind of morals and ethics that I looked up to in role models, is those people that push those minorities into the forefront.
Preach, yeah, so 100%. So that's great, you know, if it's people within like disability or if it's other people within other backgrounds, that, you know, we're all lifting up each other. We're all trying to level out the playing field, no matter, you know, your level of disability or if you don't have a disability, whatever it may be. But it's, you know, lending your voice that, you know, adds girth and weight to a certain topic that might want to be pushed forward, whatever it may be. If it's something that's, you know, to do with Aboriginality, you know, what I'm very passionate about, being a Wanneroo Kamilaroi man, and disability, and then there's other topics that, you know, that I'm passionate about as well. So, and it's good, you know, if it's someone with a disability that might be passionate about that, something that might not directly affect them, but, you know, they're lending their voice that can create and help change and have that inclusion.
In the kind of work I do, mate, I present as a white male, normally dressed in a suit that uses a manual chair, a manual wheelchair. And I find 99% of the work I do doesn't actually advocate for me. My privileges tend to mean that the community is fairly accepting of someone who looks like me. A lot of the work I do is actually promoting the rights of others which don't look like me, and that's a hell of a lot more powerful. It's really important not to pigeonhole people. You might present as a proud Indigenous male, but you might have other passions as well that you want to promote. You might not always see your Aboriginality as the thing you want to promote on that day, as the barrier you want to push, and that's absolutely your purview to do. You get to decide what your own passions are.
Mm, that's right. So, and with your passion, mate, so getting in, back into the wheelchair sport, so because from what I know about you and getting into the racing scene, like, at all, it's always intrigued me, like, how does one get into wheelchair racing? Mm. And just when it's got to be, like, fitted out for the chair itself.
Yeah.
Like, and is that a bit of a tricky balance because, you know, you've got to sort of be leaning in a right position so you can get the sort of power and the speed sort of behind you to, you know, to get moving.
Yeah. It, first of all, how I got into wheelchair athletics is a similar story to how most able-bodied elite athletes end up in a sport. I tried a bunch that I sucked at, mate. I tried wheelchair tennis and I couldn't hit the bloody ball. I tried wheelchair basketball and turned out I wasn't much of a team player. did swimming and was crap at that. And finally lucked out and found athletics. So, and that's one of those good inclusion stories that that way of going about things is fairly normal for able-bodied athletes as well. You try everything until you find what your passion is and you find what you're good at. And then trying to get through, unfortunately, going onto the chair stuff, unfortunately, I did pick one of the most expensive sports known to man. When you're trying to get into wheelchair athletics as a junior, and you're not at that level where you're getting funding from sporting organisations and those kinds of places, it's a tough slog.
Yeah.
There's a hell of a lot cheaper sports that you could be involved in than ones that involve like $5,000, $10,000 racing chairs that are, as you alluded to, all custom made to suit you. So it's a tough slog to get involved in that kind of sport as a junior. And it's actually been really one of the things that we find in wheelchair athletics is that there's a really good community of ex-athletes. And those elite athletes that are lucky enough to be sponsored to have new chairs every year, and one of the things they'll do is they'll always make sure that those old chairs of theirs will always go to a young kid that fits them, because you'll always be able to find a young kid growing up that isn't lucky enough to be able to fund their own chair that'll be
that's
that
right
size. And so one of my first chairs came from a bloke over in Canada by the name of Jeff Adams, who was lucky enough to be funded by one of the chair manufacturers, and my chair and my body type was close enough to matching his.
Nice.
So
shout out to Jeff.
My first chair come from. It's a really good community story and building a good community around sport.
So was there much like trying to fit in physically to the chair? Was there much? Because you would, if it's sitting down with the OTs and different professionals, and was that a bit of an arduous task, like tracking down, like, because this bloke's in the Northern Hemisphere and trying to track that down, and like, was it through some sort of committee, or like, how would one go about that?
Mate, first of all, OTs and physios were nowhere near involved. It was all a community deal. It was the athletes and coaches that made it happen. You got to know what your body type was. You got to know what width chair you had. And you started to look around at juniors that were starting to get into the sport. And you started earmarking kids of, you know what, if you grow a little bit, I reckon you'd be a good match for one of my chairs. And it just happened from there. It was in no way professional whatsoever. And that's what made it so good and so wholesome, mate, is the professionals weren't involved whatsoever. It was all community led and still is to a large extent now with a lot of the chairs that get handed around.
That's great. And you'd feel more ownership in a way.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and especially having the community involved and just like, cause it sounds like it was an awesome community, especially up where you were, mate, and just getting into that scene. But what
some of the things we learned as athletes back in the day, like when I started doing juniors at 10 and 12, like obviously Kurt Fernley was one of those juniors as well. And some of the things we were learning at sports camps were in no way sporting related. I know I told the story on Kurt's podcast that we one of the first things they that the older elite athletes would tell you when you rock up at a sports camp is, what the bloody hell are those handles on your chair for? You can push yourself. I don't want to see those anywhere near your chair the next time you come back. And you damn well took notice and you damn well took them off. And that was part of growing up.
So Al, just in the, like, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of disability or whatever your limitations are. It's like, get in, have a crack. This is, if you're going to get into this scene, this sport, you're going to do it this way if you want to get to this level.
Bloody oath. You're going to learn how to change your own tires. You're going to learn to make sure that you've got your own tools there. You're going to learn to make sure that your old man isn't the one carrying around the tools. Your parents aren't going to be there for you all the time. And that's the kind of things that they might have been taught in a sporting context, but they're worth a hell of a lot more than that going on into living your life as an adult.
Absolute ownership, brother. It's good to hear, you know, no matter, you know, what background or level of, you know, socioeconomic or whatever it may be, like, everybody can get in and have a crack. And, you know, disability, it just, you know, that's what drives me hearing people like yourself talk. And, like, yeah, you talked about privilege and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, where your passion does lie, it's helping a lot of those voices that aren't heard. But it's high tide raises all canoes, you know, as individuals.
So, absolutely. And you use that privilege to build others, mate. That's what you do. We see it with a lot of the Paralympic athletes that are competing these days. They cop a lot of flack for not being able to speak about topics while they're competing. And I absolutely understand their issues there. They've got government funding on the line. They've got all that. They've got sponsors. My only deal with all of them, and a couple of them have stayed absolutely firm to this, is once you do retire, then it's gloves off and you come out and you help the community that's helped you. And absolutely, that's what a fair few of them have done.
Yeah.
Got to be congratulated.
100%. And that's good, like, hearing that too, like, because it doesn't matter if you're disability or not. If you're, like, training up for, you know, Tokyo that's coming up, you know, that's your focus. Like, you might not, because you see athletes where they fall down and where they might be at a certain level and they're not applying 100% of their training because they might be doing, you know, if it's other media work and getting mixed up in stuff that they shouldn't. And then, you know, come to game day, they're not performing at the pace that they should. So
you've got a couple of years to do your Paralympic career. You've got your whole lifetime. You can be an advocate for that. You can be an advocate for your community after that. And you'll be using the profile that you build up through being good at your sport. I mean, we need to be encouraging that rather than knocking them when they tend to be a little bit quiet on some stuff.
Yeah, true. And you bring that fella's name up, Mr. Kurt Fernley. So was there a bit of a rivalry there, or was it, what was it? Because I know he's in different types of races, but did they cross paths or what?
There was no rivalry whatsoever because I got out of doing the events that he did because he bloody kicked my ass. I grew up. In the wheelchair racing world, the events that Kurt does, or Kurt did, now that he's old and retired, the events he did were like the 15 5K marathon. They're like the blue ribbon events, mate. And to be honest with you, I was no good at them. I sucked at them. I had no aerobic capacity whatsoever. I was way more suited to the sprints. And that was one of my biggest learnings going into my elite career is don't always follow the rest of the guys. Go out and be your own man and figure out your own events. And I'm glad I did. So that was how I ended up being in the sprints and being well away from having to compete with guys like Kurt.
The only time
we came together is in our relays. And most of the time when we came together in our relays, it ended in tears with both of us on the ground, mate.
Pushing your guts out. So what would a typical, like, because you're in the sprint scene, so what would a typical training regime look like?
Back when I was competing, mate, it was six days a week, twice a day. And for me, it was a lot more gym work than chair work, because in the sprint, the power to weight ratio is what's really important. I'm a pretty small guy, But I was competing against some of the guys that I was competing with, like 6'7", 6'8", standing up.
Jesus.
And for me, it was making sure that I had a good power to weight ratio was what I built my races on. So I'd get a really good start, and they'd come in with their higher top speed towards the end of the race. So I needed to be out in front early. So it meant a lot of gym work for me. So most of my work was gym work, whereas most of the your longer distance guys are doing hundreds of Ks a week, whereas I would have been lucky to do maybe 50 or 60 K in a week in a big week. And again, that shows the professionalism that started to come into the Paralympic sport, is that when you start to specialise in those different events and you start to train differently because of that, that was some of the professionalism that started to come into wheelchair sports around sort of Atlanta, sort of the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, okay. So that's what I was intrigued by, because you're thinking yourself in the sprints, because you need, bang, power off the blocks and then just need to just haul it, you know, until you're over the line. So with that, like, what would you be training for if it's because you got the power and then you got to, you know, sustain the speed? So in the gym work, would it be just general bench, or what type of equipment?
Anything to do with that bench press movement. Because when you're pushing it in a racing chair, you're basically doing a bench press, because you're lent forward in the chair and you're pushing down, rather than being laid on your back and pushing up in bench press. But basically, it's the same movement, very similar movement. So it's a lot of that chest work, a lot of that tricep work. And then the work that I'll put my hand up and say I was absolutely no good at is the shoulder stability work to make sure that you did stay all nice and all nice and injury free, and all that extra work which doesn't show off at the beach, mate, but it's really important.
Yeah, it is, and you know, because that's important too, because you know you're putting in all that work training, like, in the gym, in the chair, and then, you know, your shoulders, you're still using them when you're getting out and about every day.
You got to use them for, same as your voice and your advocacy, you're using your shoulders well after you've retired from athletics. I hurt my elbow the other day, and I'm absolutely going in circles at the moment. It's one of the stupidest things I've ever done. So that's the kind of things you got to think about as a wheelchair user, is you don't have that option of injuring anything without it being a massively big deal for you for weeks, mate.
Yeah, I'm hearing you. Look, you know, I'm a quadriplegic in an electric wheelchair, but I've got a manual wheelchair that's got electric assist, and when I push, it gives me 3 times the force. But as I start wearing out, my right shoulder's the first thing to go. Yeah. So I'm like a boat with one oar, you know what I mean? Just carrying out in circles, but it is what it is. But hey, with the sprints, like, how does it get categorized? So when you've got, because you might have different disability differences, and you said you're going up against people that are 6'7", and like, just, you know, when it's got different physicality differences and all that sort of stuff. Did you want to give us a bit of
idea there? In wheelchair athletics, you've got 4 classifications. You've got what they call T51. The T just stands for track, so it's nothing complex. You've got 51, 52, 53, and 54. Your 51s are your fairly high level quads. Your 52s have got start to bring back a bit more hand function. Hand function and arm function, but it's still well and truly a quad. Your 53s have got normal arm function, but your trunk's still impaired in some way. Mm-hmm. And then your 54s are basically what's left over. So your 54s is what ends up looking real interesting, because you end up with some single leg amputees that for whatever reason couldn't run on a running leg, so they end up hopping in a chair to compete in a chair. You end up with your double amputees that were the same, and you end up with your spinal cord guys that have got no impairment in their trunk whatsoever and their arms whatsoever, But obviously some type of impairment below the waist, which meant they couldn't run. So your 54s end up being a pretty wide spread of people. Growing up, I actually started off in 53s. I was right on that border, and classification gets really tricky, mate, and gets really controversial. I probably could have just about tried to compete as a 53, but I was pushing it. Like, I was starting to blur some boundaries of what a 53 is by trying to compete as a 53. So I actually made the choice to go, you know what, my life just isn't worth those hassles every time of rocking up to a competition and having people argue every time. So I ended up competing as 54.
Yeah, okay. I just had that thought while you were talking about it, and with the different grades, like if someone had an acquired injury and they're at a certain level, and then, you know, say 2 years down the road, they've got, with whatever their injury is, it's gotten them to, and it's like, no, I want to stay in this section because I'm just smashing it and winning all the races. So that could get murky, man. Yeah.
That's a really complex topic, because you want to make sure, and we're getting better and better with some of the research that a lot of the countries are doing, Australia included, of making sure that when we're judging people on classifications, we're judging on what they could potentially achieve.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Not necessarily exactly where they are now, because you can. If you wanted to try and fudge things, and this is the kind of story you can tell when you're long since retired, but the current guys would find it really hard to talk about without getting controversial, is you can end up with some of those guys that do purposely not train some muscle groups and try and make it look like that's part of their disability and that's part of their impairment. So there's actually a lot of research going into making sure that we're using every technology we can to try and make sure that when we're judging a person, we're judging whether those muscles can possibly be activated and not just whether they've been trained or not.
That's so interesting.
It is, mate. It's getting really funky these days and really, really interesting on a technical level.
But it's good that, you know, technology coming out, they can really zero in on what you were talking about with the muscle groups and then can really say, okay, well, yeah, like it is a massive spectrum of disability and where people fit in, but they can hone in on it a little bit more there. So, mate, how was it going from like local meets to the national stage?
Yeah, it was certainly, when you start competing at a state level and a regional level, you've got like maybe three or four people that you're competing against. And the first time you really hit one of those big meets is bloody scary, and not just scary from an athletics point of view, but also because it's generally the first time that a lot of disabled people have seen a lot of other disabled people.
Yeah.
You'll all of a sudden see, like if you've grown up not going to a school that's got an SEU or a special ed unit, or not going to a segregated school, which I was lucky enough not to, then the first time you rock up at a big sporting event can be the first time that you've seen some, I remember the first, one of the, my biggest shocks was seeing a real high level quad start to spell stuff out on a board with their feet. And for me, that was one of the most mind blowing experiences that I've ever seen. It was, holy crap, these guys are, this is daily life for these guys that I just had no concept of, because of that privileged upbringing that I had and the particular disability that I had. I had no clue of some of these things that were out there and were daily life for some of our community. And again, that's something that I've, that stayed with me, and making sure now that when I do the work I do is finding those people that have had those completely different life experiences to what I've had, so that when I speak, I'm not just speaking about me. I'm speaking about a broad community.
Yeah, so, and that's great, mate. And
I didn't really touch too much on sport there, mate. Sorry, I'm not really good at answering questions sometimes.
Hey, mate, you're doing fine. It's all good. Just keep the ball rolling. You're doing fantastic, brother. So, that's so interesting. You know, when you just see just the body and just people with disabilities or people that don't have disabilities, just the body mechanics and what people can achieve and how different nerves affect this and that. And, you know, when you're seeing some people doing in the Paralympics doing archery and they're, you know, using their feet to pull back the compound bow and bang, you know, bullseye, thanks for coming. It's just the marvel of that. So it's great. And
It's interesting you use the word marvel of that. A lot of people would use the word inspiration, and it gets us in a whole lot of trouble when you start looking at people doing certain things as inspirational. I like the fact that you use marvel, because it is. It's absolutely marveling that people can do that stuff. That doesn't have to mean that you watching that, you're watching it in a negative connotation.
Yes.
You can be absolutely blown away by some of the things that people can do and achieve with their bodies. And that doesn't have to always be in a negative. Inspiration porn is the term we throw around there. It doesn't have to always be seen in that negative light. I watch some of the Paralympic guys do some stuff that I could never do in a million years. I'm bloody amazed by it.
100%.
I've got a disability.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm the same too, like when I'm watching the Paralympics or other sports. But you're right about inspiration. It's just like flogging a dead horse, like the way that it's used, you know, well, overused. So, and yeah, it's frustrating. So I mean,
it's different if you're watching someone eat a banana and you're thinking that's inspirational, then yeah, that's absolutely pushing some boundaries. But if you're watching someone do something that's truly extraordinary for anyone to have achieved, then absolutely have at it and be bloody impressed at what they do.
Bloody hope. So, mate, internationally, you've done pretty well. Give us some of the highlights.
Yeah. Funnily enough for me, I was lucky enough to be one of those Paralympic athletes that competed in Sydney, mate. So anyone that competed in my era about international highlights, and they're probably gonna struggle just because Sydney was the be all and end all for any sports person, be they disabled or able-bodied. I did Sydney and I did Athens, and Athens was great for different reasons. Obviously a whole lot of history for the Olympics in Athens, so that part of it was fantastic. But nothing will ever beat Sydney from the standpoint of just being amazed at having people in the stands cheering for you instead of that Swedish bloke or that Finnish bloke in the lane next year, because I tell you, that gets old real bloody quick. But on the international stuff, though, traveling as a disabled person was another real big eye-opener, because you got to, across our states in Australia, we don't tend to treat people with disability too differently. So the experience that are outside of going into a real regional or remote area, you don't tend to get too much difference in the way a person with a disability is treated in Australia. But having that ability to travel certainly opens your eyes up to some of the different ways that societies view people with disability. And that was probably the most eye-opening experience from the international stuff that I did on the sporting level.
So positive and negative,
absolutely.
The different cultures of how it's like, we don't want a bar of where, you know, people with disability get put over in that corner, or some cultures are more inclusive. So
I've got a Japanese missus, and I've certainly been educated a little bit more on the way that some of the Asian countries see people with disability. You find it when you travel through some of those airports that a lot more stuff gets done for you and done to you.
Yeah, and, okay.
They honestly don't mean that as a bad thing. They're honestly trying to. That's part of their culture that they help. They help people that they see as less fortunate to them, and that just happens to be a different culture than what a lot of the other countries, your more Western countries, have got, where you tend to be allowed to do a lot more stuff independently there. It's a big cultural shift for a lot of people.
Yeah, true. And what's it like up there? You know, you got Tokyo, bloody 30 million people or whatever it is in one city. Like, have you gone back over there much with your family, and what's accessibility?
No, I actually haven't been lucky enough to, mate. The missus has gone back a few times since we've been together. I haven't been lucky enough yet, but the experiences that I've certainly been able to gather is the way they talk about access is actually really interesting in Japan. They don't talk about disability access. They talk about barrier free. Barrier free is their term. That when you go to a hotel and you ask for an accessible room, they'll talk about giving you a barrier free room, which I actually find can be seen as quite empowering and quite good language. To me, that's a lot more universal. You're not necessarily talking about one disability group catered towards people that use a chair. It's being catered a lot more universally to a lot more different, a few different cohorts of people with disability. When you talk about barrier free, that you're removing barriers that the society that they acknowledge in the social model of disability. If you want to get all complicated about it, they acknowledge that society's put some barriers up, and these rooms and these services and these products are there to remove those barriers for you.
That's so interesting.
I really like that.
So do I. I love that. Go Japan. So, like, just knowing that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a person with a disability, if you're elderly or a mother with a pram, or, you know, you need all the different universal, what we'd say over here, universal
access. Yeah, we'd call it universal access over here. They call it barrier free. Yeah.
Spot on. Go back, we'll reel it back again. Just going to the Olympic Village, because I've always been intrigued by that. Accessibility, how was it?
Obviously, when they do it, when a country tenders for an Olympics or Paralympics, they make sure that they've got their stuff sorted. The access within a village is normally fairly top-notch. The mind-blowing thing, again, is just seeing that range of people with disability. When you walk into the dining hall for the first time, to see that range of disability groups and that range of different mobility aids and the range of different ways that people are achieving things, that's the mind-blowing experience. People talk a lot, though, about the legacy of games, and they talk a lot about the legacy of what does the access of a particular host city end up? Does it end up being increased as because you've held a Paralympics? Honestly, mate, I think the jury's out on that one.
True.
You can always find good news stories of different pockets of access that's come about because a host city has hosted a Paralympics, but unfortunately the way politics works, the way media works, there's still a fair few short-term gains there and not enough long-terms in my book.
Spot on. Totally agree. So do you still keep those shoulders warm, mate, getting in the racing chair and getting around the track or what?
Mate, I've actually started just over the last couple of years doing a bit more wheelchair racing again. Absolutely not touching sprints. I've actually gone into doing the half marathon, the half marathons and the 10Ks to try and be a fit 40-year-old for absolutely no reason other than that. Just because fitness is important, whether you're disabled, whether you're able-bodied, keeping some level of fitness is important, and it's been a big challenge. 2020 was meant to be the years, meant to be the year that I stepped up to doing marathons. Last year was my year of doing half marathons. 2020 was meant to be my year of moving up and doing some marathons. And obviously COVID put pay to that. So next year again's the year, mate.
Next year, 2021's a year.
We're always trying to keep fit, mate. Like the latest thing that I've started doing is doing a bit of self-defense training.
Which
is...
Talk me through that, because tell you, I love combat sports and just jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, all of that stuff. Tell us what you're doing, brother.
Awesome. So I started doing Krav Maga, which is Israeli martial arts, Israeli self-defense. And started it as a bit of a mixture of things. Obviously, the self-defense component, as a person with a disability, I've said a few times, got a fair amount of privilege. I know that I could probably handle myself better than most disabled people if ever I needed to. But there's still that level of knowing that you're going to be a little bit more vulnerable than an able-bodied person. So learning how to use your body and to the best of its abilities is hugely important. And that's something that Krav Maga, an adaptive Krav Maga, does. You find what works for you. For when they do it with guys in power chairs, a lot of it is using your chair as your weapon. Because they're big, they're heavy, they bloody hurt when they hit you, mate.
Yeah. That's it. Me sitting in this is over 200 kilos. So when I put it in top speed, mate, you know, if I'm over feet or legs, you know, that wouldn't tickle. So
no. And looking at what I know is your joystick and your display there on your chair. The kind of stuff that I'm doing now is teaching you more so in your brain to recognize what you can use. And I can recognize that as being something that wouldn't be too pretty for someone's face to match, mate.
That's true. Absolutely
the kind of thing that you start thinking through. It's a lot less physical than it is mental. I'm just looking at what's around you and thinking, what could I use?
Yeah. Because you never know what situation you're in. You know, you're out with your family, your daughter and your wife and your three dogs, and then if you get some attacker and you get put into a certain position, and then you know how to, doesn't matter your disability, you know how to utilize that to defend yourself and your family. That's what it's all about. But you know, plus if it's a way of also, you know, because it's good mental stimulation like martial arts, but also keeping fit.
It tests my brain. Like I always joke with my instructor. I don't think she's had too much involvement with what I'd call dumb sports people, and I fully consider myself a dumb sports person. I did the sprints. My only job was to hit something as hard as I could for 15 seconds, for 14 seconds. That's all I did. I didn't need to think too much to do that, mate. To be able to think through some of the moves and some of the positions and technical stuff that you've got to do in martial arts and self-defense has been the biggest challenge for me, to be able to get that coordination going. I got none of it.
You're all right. We never stop learning. So, mate, you've been pretty modest about not talking about your medals or anything. You've had some podium finishes, yeah? So, but you've had some solid podium finishes, but when it's talking about some of the medals that you've got at Sydney, when you're looking at the gold and everything like that,
The older you get, I still do a fair few speeches and what you'd call an inspirational speech. And as you get older and older, your medal tends to come out later and later in the speeches, because you got more and more things that you've gone through in your life that you see as much bigger than that one race, that one day.
But it was
lucky enough to win the 100 metres in Sydney, and it'll absolutely be one of the days that I'll always remember.
Yeah.
But the further and further you move on in your life, you start to realise that the things that you learn from sport and the experiences that you had a lot of them weren't sports related. One of the biggest things that I find in my advocacy work is when you're the sports person, you always got to ask by the politician for the selfie and for the signature.
Yeah.
So, funnily enough, when you move into working in the more corporate, the more government relations space, that means that when you are in a room with that, with those types of politicians from now on, you don't tend to hold them in quite highest esteem as what other people tend to.
Yeah.
And you tend to be that guy that'll call a spade a spade. Mm. Whereas other people get caught up as, oh, no, you can't say that to the minister. Bugger off, you can't say that to the minister. You'll be respectful, absolutely. And honor their position and honor them as a position and honor them as a person. But if they're wrong, they're wrong, mate. And that was one of the biggest learnings I had from sport is that you treat people respectfully, but you treat them you treat everyone the same, no matter how they come to you.
Awesome. And so moving on from, so you've meddled up and then talking about another medal, the OIM. Do you want to explain to the listeners and viewers what that is and what it means to you, mate?
Yeah. Honestly, Jake, the OIM means a hell of a lot more than gold medal. Everyone wants to see the gold medal, but the OIM actually means more. If I had a choice to bring out the OIM or the gold medal, I'd bring out the OIM every time because it means that you've... it means you've actually been an upstanding role model. It means way more than you being good at being able to bash something for 14 seconds. It means that you've been an upstanding role model in the community. So for me, the OIM actually means a hell of a lot more.
So that's good.
The one that I talk about every time if given the choice, buddy.
Yep, 100%. So... social inclusion. It's important for us mob with disability, and you're a strong advocate, you're a strong voice in this field. So what drove you into this sector, mate?
Yeah, for me, I got into the sector because as a Paralympic athlete, you're asked to do those speeches like community organisations, and you're asked to do those speeches by government and by corporates. So that's how I kind of got exposed to what inclusion and diversity is. But for me, I've just always had that ingrained ethics and morals that everyone deserves a fair chance. Everything that I do is about leveling that platform and making sure the person with a disability is seen, and that their life is seen as just as valid and just as worthy as their able-bodied peers. That's what everything I do is about. So in the inclusion space is about making sure that people with disability have got the right tools and the right experience, the right knowledge to be able to even out the disadvantage that they're going to have in their life. So that when they go up against a corporate in a discrimination case, that not that David versus Goliath argument every time.
Like Graham Innes versus Rail Corp.
Jeez, yeah. Mate, you're all over this. Graham's a perfect example. He was a disability discrimination commissioner. So he went into that argument with a hell of a lot of privilege from experience from having that role. It's even harder for I always think of your average Joe or Jane person with a disability. How would they tackle those kind of arguments?
That's right.
If you've got need to be able to tackle them.
Yeah. And that's what I always struggle with, you know, like because you've got these people, like if it's Graham Innes as yourself, people that are in the disability sector that like are strong voices. And like, that's what I always worry about. You know, it's people that might, that have disability that are from, you know, so if it might be low socioeconomic, they might not have the knowledge or the structure that's themselves or through their parents, their community, whatever it may be. And they just can't bring the argument to the table, you know, and that's where we really need to get in and have a crack. And whether it's, you know, if it's strong, you know, advocation, you know, strong, you know, consultancy service provision, whatever it looks like, to raise it up, because, you know, there needs to be strong voices like yourself. And how did it, what were those steps, brother? Like when it, like if you got inclusion moves, so you've hung up the wheels for it a bit after, you know, getting your medals and doing that and being a Paralympian, and then now.
I did 10 or 15 years working for service providers before I started Inclusion Moves. I've done work with government, I've done work on a couple of policy initiatives, worked for the National Disability Services, the peak body for disability services for a while, and then had a number of what you'd call customer service or customer relations roles with human services providers before I started Inclusion Moves a couple of years ago. In all of those roles, it was about making sure that you're centering the person with a disability in the conversation. A lot of the work I did for human services orgs was around complaints management. And that work revolves around making sure that you're listening, making sure that you're authentically listening to what was the experience of your customer. What was the experience of that disabled person that's led them to make the complaint? And that's the kind of skills that I still use now in Inclusion Moves.
Mm. So you've built up all those tools over the years, gaining different experiences, which is great. You know, it's multi-diverse, looking at different disability, you know, sectors, if you will, and building that up and gathering it up, bundling it up, and then it's okay. Inclusion Moves. And, you know, what I love, what I see that you do, mate, when it's got to do with social policy and just trying to change, you know, if it's perception and what you're doing there. So what do you, when it's got to do with social policy and if it's bringing legislation and everything else into the mix, what do you channel through Inclusion Moves? And if it's, what do you channel and a breakdown of Inclusion Moves that you push forward, if it's through your advocacy consulting, throw it out there.
Biggest question I always ask people, which I think it illustrates how I work when I work in an advocacy or a policy space, is you look at you're treating a person with a disability in XYZ manner. Would you do that to a lady, to a female? Would you do that to a person from a cross-cultural background? Would you do that to your white middle-class male? If you wouldn't, then why the bloody hell are you doing it to a person with a disability? In a nutshell, that's 90% of my work is asking that question. Why do you feel as though you're able and allowed? You think it's okay to treat a person with a disability different to what you would treat your major customer cohorts? Because if you can't answer that question and answer that question in a way that you're comfortable, and I pretty much guarantee you're not going to be able to, if you can't answer that question, then you've got to start doing some pretty tough thinking about how you see your, about working through your customer journey and are you valuing your customers with disability? If we're talking about a service provider or a transport provider, if you can't answer that question of why you think it's okay to treat a person with a disability differently, then yeah, you've got some thinking to do.
See, yeah, that
it's actually got on. Inclusion and diversity, mate, it's actually quite simple.
Yeah.
We can make it as complicated as we want. All these philosophical arguments, but it comes down to, are you treating a person with a disability differently to you treating the rest of your customers? And if you are, what makes you think that's justified?
Yeah, spot on. And like what you're doing, that carries a lot of volumes through all different sectors, what you touched on there, whether it's got to do with retail, general disability service provision, you know, if it's got to do with access out into the community through, you know, Rail Corp, you know, Queensland, where you are, like so many sectors. So how has it been And like, because it's still rolling out in Queensland with the National Disability Insurance Scheme, second biggest reform since Medicare. So how did that, how's it looking up there in Queensland, and how, when it did start rolling out, how did it affect like your thoughts of where you interject yourself with inclusion moves? And like, because it's now you're looking at it not just state-based, they're all binded in, it's federal. Yeah. So how did that change for you?
First thing that I'll say about the NDIS is I get asked my opinion on how the NDIS works for me a lot. I get asked it by mostly government figures and service provider figures. And I'll always say, I very, very rarely give my opinion on how it works for me personally, because I am absolutely unique. I was a Paralympic athlete. I got profile.
Because I wasn't personally asking like how you utilize it.
I basically argue for a living, so I know.
Love it.
When I go into a planning conversation with an LAC, as in the model that we've got up here, I'm gonna win, mate. I'm not your regular Joe or Jane person with disability. I'm gonna win, and that's absolutely not fair. That's not fair by a long shot. Mm-hmm. We have not made this work until it does work for your regular Joe and Jane person with a disability, whether they've had my background, whether they've had my privilege, whether they live where I live, whether they live in the middle of nowhere, where there's limited service provider choice. Until we've made it work for those people, we haven't made it work.
Yeah, you're spot on. Like, it's so tricky, and with the NDIS, and they keep changing the goalposts, and everybody's got to try and keep up with it and know what's going on, because it's just an intricate web, like, throughout all states and territories. And do you have the experience, like, where, well, I've personally had this, where I don't, you know, because I don't have to necessarily tell people I'm in a wheelchair when I'm going to a meeting. I'm just, let's lock it in for 2:30 p.m. No worries, see you next week. And then they don't know you're in a chair, and then I'll wheel in, and then it's like the look on their face, it's like you're on their team, or their whole perception. Have you had that?
Oh yeah, have that in a corporate world all the time. When you're employed as an inclusion and diversity management consultant, people will still be surprised when you rock up and you are what the community would see as a diverse person in themselves. People are still surprised by that. That blows me away. And it shows to me that we've still got a hell of a long way to go in making people with disability be a norm in society. If you were to employ an Indigenous advisor, I'd shudder to think that you would expect a white guy to show up.
It happens.
Really? Serious?
That's another conversation.
Open a can of worms.
I thought I was making
a good point there, because I thought we would have moved past that.
No, true.
People with disability to try and move past as well.
We want to
try and make sure that when a person with a disability is employed, they're employed because of what they can do, not because they happen to have the disability. That might bring a little bit more life experience, but that shouldn't be the reason they're employed. They should be there because they know how to do the job.
That's it, 100%. Not just like it's tokenistic, just throw them in there because they've got the disability, and because that company, if they need to win a tender for, I don't know, whatever the job may be, to have 5% of people that are, have disability and blah, 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 like, that needs to be raised up.
What I find in the corporate world, Jake, is I'll go out and I'll ask the corporate, so how many people with disability you've got working for you? Like, what's your current statistics? And they'll go, I don't know. And then their So that in itself is a bad sign. But then they'll go and count the ones that they've got.
Mm.
And counting the ones you've got is a good first step, but all you've really done is count the ones that have managed to bash their way through that glass ceiling. Mm. You haven't actually bought any more in. You've only got the strong ones that have been able to bash their way in, and you can do a hell of a lot more than that.
Spot on, yeah, because there's so many people that I've met through the community. Like, yeah, I'm a quadriplegic with an acquired disability, but like I've, even before I was in a chair, like I've got family, like my youngest brother that's on the spectrum. So I've always known disability, and as a family, like there's been a lot of trials and tribulations, but of what goes on with that and how you deal with that as a, you know, as a family, even though that was lived experience through family in that sense. And now it's a, you know, I've got this disability going on now, but it's, there's so many people within the community that I know with disability, I'm like, and you're having these conversations and it's like, why aren't you in, like, this is just me thinking, like, you could be in this position and be doing this, or you could be in that position and doing this. And then because you get people that'll roll into a meeting, you know, where they might be applying for a job, and you get this person that's sitting behind the desk and they'll already have this notion built up in their head of the capabilities of that person.
Low expectations, mate. It's community still got bloody low expectations of people with disability. You'd be amazed the amount of times that I rock up at a meeting, and people will be genuinely surprised that I'm not today. But generally, people will be genuinely surprised that I'm wearing a suit and tie.
Mm.
And it's mate. How low are your expectations of me as a professional that you think just because I've got a disability, I'm not going to dress appropriately for the job?
God, that pisses me off. Yeah.
And that shows the low expectations that sadly we've still got in the community. You get a hell of a lot of people with disability that go, oh wow, you dress really well.
Yeah. Oh, clap, you know, clapping him in. Oh, he's wearing a suit, you know.
And it's no one. And that's a really small example that shows the attitude that shows, unfortunately, the attitudes that sit behind it and the morals that sit behind the worth that the society still sees as of a person with a disability.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, mate. Like, you know, I just get so frustrated with it. But where I've seen people like that have got even higher physical disabilities than me, they can't really use their arms, but the way that they can use Dragon as speech to text and use other assistive technology mechanisms, and like the way that they can utilize and just speed up the process of their work and keep up, they can go faster than some of their colleagues that have all four limbs working.
Yeah,
I've seen it, you know.
One of the things we noticed during COVID is the amount of people with disability working from home and being able to work from home a hell of a lot more. And to me, that's kind of a double-edged sword, mate. It shows that that a person with a disability can work when they've got all their adaptive aids right in front of them.
Mm.
And that's all well and good, and that's bloody awesome that we're bringing more people with disability into the community. Into the workforce, but why the bloody hell couldn't we have done that in physical employment locations?
We needed a pandemic to show them.
Yeah. there's no reason why those reasonable modifications couldn't have been happening in workplaces well before now.
And how's it looking for you? So, like, it's put a lot of us people back, like, in different, you know, disability or not, pandemic hit, bang, righto, a lot of people are working from home using this medium, which is Zoom, or if it's Microsoft Teams, whatever.
Yeah.
And how's it been going for yourself, it's mate?
Doing inclusion and diversity work, Jake's a bit tough online. I find people don't take stuff that's said online as serious. When you're in a room and you're talking about upholding the rights of people with disability, that face-to-face contact that you get, people, it's a confronting topic. and people are kind of forced into confronting some of the demons they got going on in their own head. And honestly, I think we lose a bit of that when we're trying to do stuff online. People find it a little bit too easy to be a little bit removed, and not take the conversation quite as seriously. I can't help but think that when you say to a person, you see the rights of a person with a disability as important, right? In person, you'll see that little look up to the sky of, how do I answer this question? And answer it in a way that he's going to like. Online, it's too easy to miss that stuff.
I know, yeah.
And that stuff is really important to knowing whether that person's actually speaking from the heart and really owning that statement, or whether they've gone into public speaking mode and they're making it up what you want to hear on the spot. So can't wait to start doing some more stuff in person, mate. It's been a tough year.
Yeah, it has. So what's it generally look like, mate, with, like, if it's inclusion moves, the important work that you're doing, or if it's got to do with the, like, general advocacy?
Yeah.
Because it's been up and down, and like when it's got to do with funding, or there are organisations that are self-sustainable to some degree, but what is the general advocacy to do with disability been looking like throughout this year?
One of the things that we've actually had a good benefit from COVID is that it's actually brought the disabled community together, I think, a hell of a lot more. With more and more people doing some stuff online, it's put us on more of a level platform. We've come together a hell of a lot. And some of the work that I do, like I chair the National Inclusive Transport Advocacy Network, and knowing that there's issues like transport, which are a big issue, but when you're talking about advocacy organisations and peak bodies that deal in health, they deal in housing, they deal in abuse, neglect, as we've got going on at the moment with the Royal Commission, you know that something like transport is always going to be tough to get onto the priority list, and I absolutely get that. What we've done a lot this year is building up those groups of people that are passionate about something. Knowing that we don't need to necessarily talk about something on every given day, but a lot of the work that I've done has been about making sure that when something hits the fan, and a piece of legislation is dropped that's open for consultation, that you've got that core group of people that are absolutely up to speed on that topic, and they're ready to get out there and cause hell or high water to cause a fuss and achieve good outcomes for people with disability.
Where are you making waves? 100%. And where are you like pushing for? Where are you making waves when it's like looking at policy legislation, whether to do with transport or whatever it is? What's the direction that you're
Paneling? Biggest issue, I kind of alluded to it earlier, the biggest thing that I'm pushing in everything that I do at the moment is around putting more data in the hands of people with a disability, whether that's in the disability standards around public transport, making sure that we're keeping note of compliance and how compliant transport providers are in that space. That's a piece of information that's crucial for people with a disability to know, whether it's National Disability Strategy, the outcomes reporting that's being talked about for that, making sure that we're taking those outcomes and those measures and those indicators seriously there, because again, that puts good information in the hands of people with disability. And I talked yesterday on the National Disability Data Asset. And again, that's about building data. That's about making sure that you're putting the right information and good quality trusted information in the hands of people with disability that they can use to illustrate how good or how bad the social inclusion of their life is going. So I'm on a bit of a data-driven and knowledge-driven bent at the moment, mate, to make sure that we build people with disability up with more information. So they're not having to go to, if you were to do a complaint around a transport issue, you'd have to engage an access consultant to do a lot of the work for you. You'd have to engage lawyers to go and do that research for you. I don't want people with a disability to have to go through that hassle. I want them to be able to see and find and use that good trusted data, have it at their fingertips so that they've got that head start, because that little bit of a head start can make a hell of a big difference when you're taking on someone like you said with RailCorp.
Mate, I'm glad you bring up the National Disability Data Asset. I've done a bit of work with these guys, and that's you're spot on. Data, building it up for, you know, it's not just for the, if it's service providers and people like that out there, it's for the individuals that do have disability. Like if it's like myself, like, and I'm thinking now, like, how's it going to work with, like, Qantas laid off a whole lot of people, like, and, you know, because I do fly here and there for work, and like, because I need an eagle hoist / lift, like, how's it, are they going to have the trained personnel up there? Like, can we, are we going to record that within the data asset? So, you know, because we're not people with disability in chairs, we're not just getting around in vehicles like on the road, we're flying, we're trying to travel like everybody else is. So what's that going to look like?
When we talked about data, I automatically exchange the word data for knowledge, because data's a bit, for most people, data's a bit, gee, I don't really know what that is. That's data, that's numbers. To me, I substitute the word knowledge in there, so that you got the knowledge to be able to go in and make a good argument from the start. And that translation from data, from the cold hard data, to knowledge that's informed by and led by people with disabilities is going to be really important in that space.
100%. Inclusion moves forward. You're going to keep up the perpetual motion going 2021. So is there what, and keeping up the constant argument moving forward and for mob with disability, what's it look like for Jeff Trapper and inclusion moves 2021 onwards? What's the plans?
We get some really big ticket items in the disability policy space that are going to be going on next year. Disability stands for accessible public transport will be start to be talked about publicly, and the public consultation will start to go ahead for that. National Disability Strategy will be talking about the outcomes for that. Some really big key headline policy documents, which everyone in the sector and everyone in the disabled community is going to need to be doing their bit to translate that down to information and knowledge that your regular person with a disability can understand. Because you and me, mate, we can have a conversation about those policy instruments.
That's right.
Every person with a disability shouldn't need to have worked in the sector for 10 years to be able to get it.
I know, and just breaking it down every time.
We don't engage too well with just your regular grassroots person with a disability who shouldn't need to know all of the ins and outs of how those policy instruments work. They just want to know how are they going to have an equal life as the able-bodied person next to them. That's all they want to know. So a lot of that translation work, I reckon, is what's going to be the focus next year.
Beauty. So your important work needs to be mapped across, you know, the nation, the one that's sitting behind me there, Australia. So very important, especially when it's got to do with, you know, corporate advocacy, National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDS, all things disability, corporates, service provision, blah, blah, blah. So how can people get a hold of you, your organisation, and the important work that you do?
www.inclusionmoves.com.au is the website. Inclusion Moves on all your social medias, and you'll find me, mate. I tend to be a little bit less professional on my Instagram than I am on my Twitter, and a little bit less professional on my Twitter than I am on my LinkedIn. That's who I am, mate. I'm never going to pretend to be the most professional fella you'll find. tender, you gotta meet your customers, and you gotta be authentic to who you are. And I want people to employ authentic people with a disability, so I'm absolutely gonna role model that.
Spot on, mate. Don't you change. I know you won't. You just said it. So you heard the man, you heard his details. So there's a lot of important work that needs to be done when it's got to do in regards to all things disability. So Jeff, mate, I really appreciate you, you know, having a yarn with us. And I'll look forward to the important work that's going to go, you know, from here out to the end of the year and 2021 onwards, brother. So good luck with everything moving forward, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, mate. Talk soon.
Cheers, brother. See you, mob. Mr. Trappett doing solid work, wheeling around the nation, creating social policy change. People, get on board. Look him up. We need to add more to the conversation just to keep creating social policy change for people with disability. Solid work, brother. Keep it up. And if you like the podcast, hit the subscribe button. It'd be much appreciated. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And you can also find us on Facebook. Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. And want to thank our sponsors, Permaville Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.